Good evening. As always, we want to thank Carl for bringing the cross forward for us. And I invite you to pray with me. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. So we've been doing this series kind of through some of the parables, and this is yet another parable. And we're going to go through them probably for the next month or so and just see what kind of discoveries we make. But there's an old African tale about two brothers who were in a flour mill business. And one of the brothers was married and the other and had children. And the other brother was single and had no family. And they were equal partners in this business. And they made an agreement between each of them and said at the end of the day, they would take all of the extra flour and divide it between each brother to put in his own barn. And one day, the single brother began to think, here am I with only myself to care for, and while my brother, he has a wife and he has a family and his children to support and to feed, and it's not fair to divide the flour evenly. My brother should have more flour than I have. So later that night, he took some of the flour from his barn. And so as not to be embarrassed or embarrass his brother, rather, he went under the cover of darkness to his brother's barn and secretly left all of that extra flour in his brother's barn. It just so happened that at that very same time, the other brother with the family and the children began to think, here I am with a family and children, and I have all of these blessings in my life, and my brother doesn't have anyone. I have children, and my brother takes care of no one, and he's just by himself, and he's lonely. So my brother should get more of this flour than I get. So he took some of his flour, and under the darkness of the night, slipped into his brother's barn and left the flour there. And every night, unbeknownst to each other, this was happening. Always amazed the next day, both of them, how is it that our flour is not going down? The level is remaining the same. Until one night, their arms covered with sacks of flour, they met each other in the darkness and realized what each of them were doing. And with tears of loving joy in their eye, the two brothers embraced in the darkness. And according to the old tale, when God saw them embrace, God touched that spot on the earth and said, this is where I'll build my house. For my house must always be a place of great joy. Building on this theme of joy that we have around the holiday seasons, particularly the Christmas season. I love the Christmas season. In fact, I think I go into a depression after the Christmas season. I have this high. I don't want it to end because there's so much joy. You know, and I wonder sometimes, are people talking to me just because it's the holiday, or is this their natural nature? You know, people, you cross people on the street and they're smiling at you and they're happy and they're joyful. Even in the midst of all that's going on, there's so much joy. Are there many occasions in your life for joy? Just think about it. Have you ever experienced a time when you come to worship and the songs just touch your heart in such a way? Time when the words of the creed or the Lord's prayer or the morning prayer or the message maybe penetrate your soul in such a way that it spoke to your very situation. Have you ever walked out of these doors or the doors of any church and said to yourself, I was glad that I was there? Don't acknowledge. I'm not looking for affirmation. I just want you to think. I was glad that I was there. There are a lot of people for whom experience of the Christian faith is not joyful. Maybe that's why many people in our society have and continue to decide to stay away from the church altogether, because what they experience there does not make them glad in their hearts. Now, when the psalmist says he was glad when they said unto me that he should go into the house of the Lord, he wasn't talking about going to church, or even going to a sanctuary and participating in worship. David's talking about the whole fabric of faith, what you and I claim to be faith. The house of God is not just a building. The house of God is not just a building. It's wherever God's people gather. The house of God is at your address, whatever that is. The house of God is at your workplace. The house of God is at that tent for that unhoused person down the street. The house of God is at that shelter where someone is recovering from whatever addiction they have been challenged with in their life. The house of God, it's wherever God's people meet. There is the house of God. And that is what is intended to be experienced in the joy in the presence of God. The house of God, the place where God and God's people meet, should be a place of joy. I'm not talking about denying the challenges that we face in life or denying the realities of the world, but the house of God, it should be a respite. You know, in our home, we take off our shoes when we enter the house, and that's traditionally an Asian cultural thing, because the idea is I'm leaving all of that stuff outside. And this place is a sanctuary for me. This place is a place where I experience love and joy and peace. But there are many of us for whom the word joy is not the best description of faith. We think of ourselves as faithful people. We're willing to defend our faith sometimes and maybe even argue for our faith. It gives us guidance for living. But it seems more like a responsibility sometimes when you talk about faith. It seems like an obligation than a deep joy. Do you have deep joy? I want you to think about it. Is there deep joy when you think about your faith? This is not in my notes, but it reminded me of the story, the joke of the young man who was still unmarried, living at home with his mom. And his mom went into his room one day and said, "Son, you got to get up for church." "Mom, I don't want to go to that church today." "Why don't you want to go to that church?" "Those people are mean. They talk about me. They don't like me. The music is bad. Son, you got to go to church." "Why do I have to go to church, Mom?" "First of all, the people are not mean. They don't talk about you. Secondly, you're the pastor." Some people even feel condemned by religion, judged and shunned and shamed. So as for the intense, freeing, overflowing, exhilarating, life-changing sense of joy, is that what you experience when you think about coming to church? Not just this church, whatever faith community you find yourself in. Can we really say, "I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord"? Why is this that we can't say that on occasion? Why is this? A few years ago, I led a group of 47, many years ago, actually, I led a group of 47 people from the church I was serving in Scottsdale, Arizona, on a mission trip to Jamaica. And one of the things that, you know, I'm coming from this very, very affluent community. A community where the pipe organ in that church cost $7 million. And one of the things some of the members of that church said, we went to a worship service, and he said, "How come these people are so happy?" Some of them living hand to mouth. And what we, our garage is probably better than some of the homes that they live in. Why are they so happy? Why do they have so much joy? It totally reframed the narrative that they took back to North Scottsdale. These people were so happy, even in the midst of all that they were lacking. In the lesson that was read for you today, Luke tells us that one day Jesus had a conversation with some people. And we've been talking about the Pharisees a lot lately in some of the parables that we're looking at. And the people were having some problems with joy. You ever have a problem with joy? You ever feel like you have to fake the funk? and smile because people expect you to smile, but really deep down inside, it's just really hurting. You ever have a problem with joy? These people were having a problem with joy, and they were Pharisees. Now, we've been taught to think bad things about the Pharisees, and we have even lifted up some not so good things about the Pharisees in the past. They're villains, but the Pharisees weren't all bad. And just like all of us, there's a little bit of bad and a little bit of good in all of us. The Pharisees were loyal in worship. They were loyal people in prayer. They were generous people. They had responsibility to give their money to the poor. I mean, those are good attributes, aren't they? They're attributes that things that we all aspire to. They fed the hungry. They honored the scriptures. They studied the scriptures. They didn't make cheap compromises with culture. I mean, I think some of those things are really good. They were people of strong faith. Even though they used their faith legalistically against other people, they were people of strong faith. Someone has observed that our churches would probably be a little bit better and a little bit stronger if we had a few more Pharisees in there. And so Luke portrays them as a group that has a problem with the kind of joy that Jesus generated, joyfully eating and drinking with sinners. Jesus was always with the wrong people at the wrong time in the wrong places and making merry with prostitutes and hanging out with tax collectors. So Jesus told them these three stories, and we are actually going to unpack all three of these parables sometime in the new year, one by one, but they're clumped together in this particular text today. The lost sheep, the lost coin, and what's the third one? The lost son. The lost sheep and the lost coin and the lost son. And like I said, in the new year, we're going to unpack all three of them individually. He told them about a shepherd who lost one of his sheep and was worried out of his mind. He went searching everywhere for the sheep. And when at last he found the sheep, he was overjoyed. This is going to be a common theme with all three of them. God is like the shepherd. Jesus said, he told them about a poor woman who had 10 coins and one of the coins was lost. So she swept her whole house, picking up everything, even looked under the sofa's cushions, you know, where we hide our stuff. And she couldn't find the coin. So joyfully, when she found the coin, she, come on, rejoiced. That's the common theme, that you lose it, you find it, and you rejoice. God is like the poor woman, Jesus told them. And then he told them a story about a father whose son took half of the family fortune and he blew it. He went out of town, lived a life of lavishness on prostitutes, and he spent all of his money living high. He was lost and he had no money to come back. The father was so enjoyed when the son came crawling back that the father never gave a thought of scolding him, but filled the house with music and festive dancing and laughter. And then Jesus said, God is like that. When you and I are lost, God comes looking for us, and God's heart is full of joy. Wherever God is, there is joy in the house. That's what these parables are intended to suggest to us. The house of God should be a place of joy because it is where the people discover what matters in life. Not what they get, but the grace that they are given. Isn't that really what matters in life? I know there's, you know, some people call it pseudo-psychology, but have you, any of you ever read the book Five Love Languages? You know what your love language is? I'll tell you what mine is. Many people think that the obvious love language for people would be receiving gifts. My particular, and I'm not saying this, listen, I'm not seeking. it's kind of odd to say this, but my love language is quality time. So if someone says, hey, can I hang out with you? All the stars go off in my head. Because time is so valuable. I can't put a value on your time or my time. So when someone carves out time and says, I want to hang out with you, that connects. So sometimes when people give me gifts and my response is just, oh, I really appreciate it. They're like, you don't really care. Well, it's not tapping into my particular love language. The house of God should be a place of joy because it's there people discover what matters in life. And for me, what matters is not the things that people can buy for me, but the time that people are willing to spend with me. Isn't it strange that so many of us who are committed Christians stay outside of the house of joy? Like the older brother in Jesus' third story, he says, what's all this noise about? He said, it's a party, replied one of the servants. A joyful party. What's the party for? Your brother is back. And so your dad threw a party for him. A party for my brother? Who wasted away all of his money and tried to make something of himself, a party for him, but something different and strange happens in the story. The father comes outside. And when the father comes outside the house, the joy and the merriment of the older brother goes like this, goes out the door. What's wrong with this older brother? You heard the reading. I've served. I've been here all my. I've done everything that you asked me to. I've never disobeyed. And then comes the touching part of the story. You never gave a party for me. I've always wanted to be joyful, but you never gave me a party. And then comes the gracious and loving reply, son, you're always with me. Everything I have is yours. There's always been a joyful party going on for you in my heart. Didn't you know that? Now come into the house and enjoy the party for your brother. I think that part of what this is saying to us, and like I said, we'll unpack all of those parables in more details later, but I think that one of the things that this is saying to us is that we will never really experience, or can we really experience joy of our faith until we realize that all of us are really outsiders who have been invited into the party. And we're invited into the party not by any merit of our own. Some of us may more be in line with the younger brother. You know, parts of our life we've wasted. And some of us may be more in line with the older brother, people who have worked really hard. And because we've worked really hard, we have a lot of resentment for the people who haven't worked as hard and yet are invited to the party. And so we are inclined to say, that's not fair. But the fact is, both of them are outsiders. The older son and the younger son. And the father invites both of them into the party. Many years ago, I read an essay in which a woman was reminiscing about her father. And she said that when she was young, she was very close to her father. The time she experienced this closeness the most was when they had big family gatherings with all of the aunts and the uncles and the cousins present. And at some point, someone would pull out the old record player and put on an old polka record. And the family would dance. And eventually someone would put on the Bear Barrel Polka. And when the music of the Bear Barrel Polka played, her father would come up to her, tap her on her shoulders and say, "I believe this is our dance." And they would dance. One time though, when she was a teenager and in one of those, you know, for any of us who have children, teenager modes, and the Bear Barrel Polka began to play, and when the father tapped her on her shoulder, she said, and said, "I believe this is our dance," she snapped at him, "Don't touch me. Leave me alone." And her father turned away, never asking her to dance again. "Our relationship was difficult all through my teen years," she wrote. "When I would come home late from a date, my father would be sitting there in his chair, half asleep, wearing an old bathrobe, and I would snarl at him, 'What do you think you're doing?' He would look at me with sad eyes, and I would just snarl at him. When I went away to college," the woman wrote, "I was so glad to get out of the house and away from him. And for years, I never communicated with him. But as I grew older, I began to miss him. And one day I decided to go to the next family gathering. And when I was there, somebody put on the Bear Polka dance. I drew a deep breath. And I walked up to my father, tapped him on his shoulder, and I said, 'I believe this is our dance.' He turned to me and said, 'I've been waiting for you.' Standing at the center of our life is a God who says to us, 'Everything I have is yours. All that I am, I've been waiting for you.' I was glad when they said unto me, 'Let us go into the house of the Lord.' I've been waiting for you." Let's pray. God, we thank you that in the midst of all the rush and the hurriedness of this season, that these faithful, committed faith members of this community present here and on Zoom have kind of put this hour away to say we want to experience the joy of each other and the joy in the presence of God. And so we thank you for their faithfulness. We thank you that you have been waiting for us to experience the kind of love that you have for us, whether we are the kind of person that just been there all the time, been faithful and committed, or we're the kind of person who's kind of explored life and wandered around and now finding our way back to some kind of faith. Wherever we are on our journey, thank you that you have been waiting for us. Amen.